Hi, everybody. I am Tom, and I am alcoholic.
Hi.
And technically, I'm from Rutgersville.
Oh.
So I actually share both counties, you know, Green and Albemarle. So thank you, Sam, for inviting me up here. It's the times that I've spoken have been to people who know me pretty well. So I know better than to lie to them. Sorry, I won't lie to you either. But it is always a little different when you don't know anybody in the room. I don't think I know anybody in the room except for Sam. And I know Wayne. Hi, Wayne. Good to see you, man. Hi. Well, now I'll tell the truth. And I know Sam and Wayne, actually, from the Green County meeting down there in a long time since. So, enough of the history. Except for I'll tell you what it was like and what happened, you know, and what it's like now. You know, I was born in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Those of you who can't pick up that accent, that's where I'm from. And it was kind of flattened out by Florida because I spent some time in Florida, and then I moved to Virginia. So, you know, it's gotten modified along the way. My dad was a drunk. My mother was also partied a little bit, but wasn't necessarily alcoholic. She had other challenges throughout her life. My early childhood, I have memories of being with my dad and being in a bar, and I have memories of my mom knocking him out with the tea kettle, you know, because he came home and she was mad at him, so she hit him upside the head. And I have memories of my dad just falling to the floor in that. And I have memories of, going of my cousins and, you know, family and good feelings with that, with, you know, his family and my mother's family. So, you know, there was some good and then some bad, you know, nothing's ever perfect. But what did happen is my dad left when I was about 5 or 6, and my mom divorced him finally when I was 9, you know. And so, you know, I grew up without a dad, and I just say that because I think to some extent it impacted my search for God. Into drugs and alcohol. I started smoking pot really first, and it's part of my story, but, you know, I'm a true blue alcoholic. Alcohol is what kicked my butt and brought me to my knees and caused me almost all the consequences that I had. And I got high with my mom. You know, this was, would have been 1970s, early 70s, you know, in Cambridge, Mass. So it was a pretty liberal place. And so, you know, her rationale is I'd rather have you doing it in the house than outside where you can get in trouble for it. And there's a certain amount of truth to that. I didn't do it with my children. Of course, I was sober by the time I got... I thought about that a lot when I was raising my kids. You know, how much permissiveness should I be as a recovering alcoholic? But I just had none. I had no tolerance for that stuff. And, I don't think it's... I don't think it did me any favors either. Because it gave me the wrong sense of idea. This stuff is, you know, not as friendly as I thought it was. You know, even pot, you know, is not as friendly to people as I thought it was growing up. So I got high, but my first drink, was one of those things where, you know, we couldn't buy alcohol legally, and so we got some of the kids from the playground to go to the liquor store, to the package store, which they called in Massachusetts, and, Schlitz, you know, not the malt liquor, but the beer, and, we got a 40, and I drank it, and I liked it. You know, I liked the fact that I was drinking, and I liked the fact that I was doing it with people. I liked the fact that I was doing it with the cool kids. You know, because until that point, I was one of these kids that was smart, you know, and did pretty well in school, and, you know, but I was socially awkward, and, you know, and the kids that I ended up drinking with were the cool kids, you know, and that was all part of, you know, what I wanted to be. I wanted to, you know, there's a part of me that certainly liked being successful at school, but there's another part of me socially that really just wanted to be liked, and these guys liked me, and one of the ways I got liked was drinking alcohol. It was also one of the ways I got to get closer to girls, right? So, you know, we got drunk together, and that was notable. You know, I'm in a social situation with alcohol that we got from this, you know, one of the older kids, and that's great. And I go home, and my mother, who was well aware of alcoholism by this point, you know, with my father's history and everything, asked me if I had been drinking. And I didn't lie. I said, yeah, Mom, but here's the funny thing, but I don't think I'll do it again. And, you know, what I started to do at that point was start to justify my drinking. You know, even at that point, I started to know that it wasn't quite right, that it wasn't quite right for me. You know, given my history with my dad and everything, you know, I really did cross a line when I decided to drink. You know, I really started doing something I thought, this might not be too good for me, but I really liked what it did. You know, like I said, it made me feel a part of, you know, made me feel part of a group. You know, it gave me that sense of belonging that I really struggled to get. You know, and that's the underlying psychology, you know, that we know, right, is that we're alone and we're socially awkward. And without alcohol, you know, we really struggle to get along with people. And that problem did not go away, you know, until I started drinking alcohol. It didn't really go away. It was still an underlying cause of my drinking. But it, you know, it just, I lost my train of thought there, but, you know, the underlying cause of my drinking was this self-centered fear and this inability to be okay with myself, and alcohol allowed me to finally break through and get some relief from the insanity, from the self-centeredness that I had in my head, and to be part of a group and be part of, and if it happened, you know, and I say that, you know, I say that with the analysis of looking all the way back, you know, 45 years now, but also, even at that time, I knew alcohol was a good tool for me. Even at that time, I knew it was something that I could use. And so, you know, that was normal, you know, so I went through what we'll call normal teenage, it was a lightweight version of teenage. I look at not only my own kids and the drinking that goes on in our society today, but I look at their individual, and I did nothing compared to what the kids today are doing. And I don't say that, you know, like, but I was a lightweight and, you know, drinking and drugging, but it didn't really matter, you know, because, like I said, it started causing trouble with my mom. You know, the moment I did it, and I said, I won't do it again. I started a little bit of lying, started taking her pot, you know, started taking a little bit of her money, you know, support my habits, so I'd go out on Friday night and, you know, drink with the guys and girls. So, you know, I tell about the first drink because it's very instructive. You know, a lot of, you know, I had every reason in the world not to drink. You know, the prohibitions of my own experience and with my father, you know, told me what alcoholism could do. The other things I was told by people well before I started drinking, you know, you're just like your dad. You know, and that was way beyond, they weren't even talking about the alcohol part, they were talking about the personality, you know, and I thought that was a positive, and I realized today that in retrospect, there was some of that, but also, they also understood who I was, they looked at the insecurity, and I knew my dad, I looked back at some of the things my dad did, and I know, you know, kind of where he was coming from, and you know, so, you know, that first drink and all the things that led up to that first drink and who I was and what happened when I started drinking and the boundaries that I crossed to start drinking. You know, and the rest of my high school career is really more of the same in the sense that, you know, I'm getting drunk and high more often. You know, I'm experiencing some consequences in school. I experienced certainly some consequences at home. I was sent to live with my father because my mother couldn't, you know, just things started happening, you know, where I was not the same kid anymore, you know. So I get through high school and, you know, I'll tell you a little bit about my high school career was, you know, a couple years in Massachusetts, you know, and a couple years in Florida. And I'll tell you a little bit about the school in Florida that I went to, because it's somewhat of a humorous story. So this school was an alternative school because my mom was working there. She'd get free tuition to a pretty decent private school. But it was an alternative school with alternative curriculum and everything like that. But one of the great things I loved about it was that kids would get high at the beginning of the morning, you know. And I would go out there and get high with them. And then I ran for student government and was elected to student representative. And I went outside to, you know, get to know my constituency better in the morning, right, so that I would get high with them before class in the morning. And that was my way of representing them. And I find that story humorous. You may not, but I find that story humorous. And I was out there and getting high before class, and that's about all there is to say about that school, except that after I graduated from that school, I ran away from home. I went back to Massachusetts. And so now, you know, I just want you to know, I'm 17, I'm taking geographic cures already. I'm running away from here, and I'm going up to Massachusetts. And I didn't have any choice about the Massachusetts to Florida trip, you know, but the trip from Florida back to Massachusetts is very much my first geographical. I'm 17 years old, and I hitchhiked up to Massachusetts from Florida, and I can't believe I did that today. I was talking to somebody the other day that I even survived that trip on 95. It was just amazing. And God looking out for drunks and fools, right? So, you know, I get up to Massachusetts, and I stay with my aunt, and we, you know, she very gracious, obviously, very graciously takes me in, but I had to leave because I started taking from her, you know, to support my habit, you know. And I ended up over at stayed with the girl. I sort of bounced around. And I got to, you know, I'm not going to go into every little detail, but this is kind of the good news is that my drunk log goes from 13 to 24. So it's really short as far as that goes. So we're going to be what it was like. We're going to be through that part pretty soon and into what happened. But, you know, I started living with people, you know, again, I started with women that I had no business being with, and I would steal from dealers, and that was really stupid, and got kicked out of places because I did that sort of stuff. And I ended up finally getting enough money together to go live on my own, and during that time, I started experiencing blackouts, you know, and I started to hang around with more and more people who the only reason I was around them was because they drank like I drank. You know, I was in the restaurant business, you know, and, you know, I guess the thing that started happening is, you know, I started having, you know, I thought that I was this kind of person. And what started happening was that I started really being this kind of person, and then I started being this kind of person. But I still thought I was this kind of person. And you know, as I sunk down and lower, you know, what started happening was the distance between who I thought I was and who I really was, the gap was getting pretty large, you know. And I, there's a lot of pain associated with that, you know, a lot of, you know, psychic pain. And you know, I started to drink more to escape, to sort of close that gap, at least in my own mind, right? So I get, I take another geographic from Massachusetts back down to Florida, mostly because there's a couple more bounces. I go back to Florida, you know, stay there for a little while. I do some work. I get accepted to college that is back up in Massachusetts. So I go back up to Massachusetts. I'm driving a cab up there. One of the things that's great for an addict and alcoholic is it's daily cash flow. And I drank and I drugged, and I was trying to go to school. And, you know, I just didn't have the horsepower, man. You know, I was one of those people that, you know, I would study when I was polluted, and then go to the test in class polluted, because I believed in similar state learning. There was this thing where if you study and you know, you've heard of this, right? Well, if you study and do everything, you know, high, you have to go high, because otherwise it just won't make any sense. And so I did that, you know, and clearly that's not an effective learning tool. But yeah, right. But nonetheless, you know, and so I ended up failing out of Boston University. The thing I took away from Boston University was about $5,000 worth of student debt, which went, some of it went to pay for my college tuition, but a lot of it went to cocaine and alcohol. So the thing about that and why I ended up, ended up going back to Florida was because as I was driving a cab, I got high one night, and, you know, while I was driving, I'm driving around the city, you know, unfortunately, and drinking and drugging, and I get stopped by the police, and they know I'm drunk, and I have a passenger in my back seat, so they take my passenger to their destination, close the cab, leave me in the cab with no keys, and say, stay with the car. And for some reason, I just knew better than to try to run. They had the cab. They would find me eventually because I knew who the cab company was. So I stayed there. But, you know, this is one of those things where, you know, when my son, he thinks he's the only one that does stupid things. I like to share this story with him, which is I decided that I needed to take the edge off the stress of my situation. So I decided to smoke a joint while I was in the cab. And the worst part about it was I didn't, like, roll down the windows. I couldn't because of the power windows, and the car wouldn't start because they had the keys rather than open up. You know, so it's just – so they come back, and I open up the car door, and, you know, that was just one more thing, you know. So, you know, we – and some of these things are funny, and they are funny. And that was just funny. You know, I just can't believe I did that. But I know I was just high. I was stupid. You know, and at least it was only me and nobody got hurt in that situation. But so the MDC police, the Metro police, are not fun people, and they did not take kindly to my doing that. So they really did throw me in the back of their car. They were so mad at me, and they took me down to jail, and I was arraigned and all that stuff. And I walked out of jail realizing that I had to leave town. So that's what I did. And had a bench warrant and everything out for me, which I eventually cleared up in sobriety. But, you know, I ran away to Florida again, so I'm back to Florida and getting jobs in restaurant business again, and nothing's really changed, and I'm drinking and drugging, you know. But on March 21st, 1982, I got my first DUI, well, my second really, right, but my first in Florida, and I... you know, that one was just, you know, I can't even remember now. I was trying to think of the circumstances around that and how I got busted. But, and for the moment, I'm drawing a blank exactly how it was. But I do remember the date because it was also the beginning of my sobriety. And I say that because it was around that time I got a big book, and inside that big book was the date, March 21st. So that's how I know the date. I still have the big book. And so March 21st in 1982 is the beginning of the end of my drinking and drugging part of the story. And like I said, it was you know, and this is just one of those things where there's nothing funny to tell about that story. I was just driving down the road, and I got pulled over, and I tried to get they did a sobriety test on me. And I failed it. They drove me down to the station. I had to call my next-door neighbor because my mother wasn't available, you know, to come get me out, you know. In there, I'm yelling racial epithets at the African-American cop, you know. And it's just, sometimes I'm just surprised I'm alive, you know, because there's so many things that I did that were just stupid. You know, one of the things I did, you know, I would start mouthing off to the big guys in the bar, you know, because at that point I was not real happy with myself, you know, and so I'm hoping they'll do something, right? You know, and clearly I did that to the cop, hoping they'd do something, and, you know, he didn't do anything. But, you know, I'm just doing stupid, idiotic things. And so, you know, I got what happened with that one is I got sentenced to AA. You know, and I don't know that they do it as much today because we don't have it around the rooms down in Charlottesville. I don't know if you have it up here, but where, you know, people come from court and we have to sign a little piece of paper. I don't know why they don't do it anymore, but they don't. We don't see it as much. But, you know, it was my introduction, you know, and the thing I liked about Alcoholics Anonymous is, first of all, I liked the stories. I mean, the people told stories very well, and they also told stories that were about me. You know, I could identify with, you know, the drunk logs, you know, the people, you know, how they got busted and things that they said, you know, in these sort of speaker stories. But I also started to hear people talk about how they felt, you know, and how they felt after the drinking, you know, and how, and not just the events like drink DWIs and all that stuff, but how they'd wake up in the morning, you know, and they knew they had sworn to themselves that they weren't going to drink the night before. And how they, you know, just like in the book, they swore that they were not going to drink. Or if they were going to drink, it was going to be two, right? And so, and then, you know, somewhere in the middle of the night, you know, they finally get themselves home. I finally get myself home. I pass out. Because I wasn't going to sleep much anymore. Even at that point, even at 21, 22, I wasn't going to sleep much. I was passing out, you know. And so I wake up and going, oh, you know, this again. And, you know, so my life was a series of days of this again, you know. And feeling like, you know, that distance between who I thought I was and who I was at that point, even though I couldn't really look at who I was that well, but I could sense who I was. I was not who I wanted to be. I was not who the person I, you know, thought I would grow up to be. And I began to understand a little bit more about my father, you know. So I said it's the beginning of my story, and it's, that took 2 years from 82 to 84 for me to finally, you know, get sober and stay sober. I was talking with somebody the other night, you know, about, you know, they were periodic drinkers. And I said, you know, my problem is not that, you know, during that time, during the time between 22 and 24, this was true. You know, I could stop with the help of Alcoholics Anonymous. I just couldn't stay stopped. And there are many people who are older than I, and even as young as I, who had that experience. They could stop for a period of time. They didn't need AA or anything, but they could never stay stopped. And that was my thing, is I couldn't stay stopped during those 2 years. You know, no matter how much AA was a help to me, no matter how motivated I was, you know, I'd stay sober for 5 months, 3 months, and longest was 16 months. And, you know, I just hadn't truly hit bottom. And then what I hope, you know, was my last drunk happened on September 12th, 1984. And those of you doing the math in the room, that's 33 years ago, a little over 33 years ago. And, and you know, clearly to say nothing's been the same since is pretty true. The thing that happened was, once again, this didn't involve any criminal things, but I woke up one morning, you know, and I woke up and I was still driving a cab, but I was driving West Palm, and I woke up in the morning and I was in the back of a cab in the cab yard. And I was wearing, those of you who may remember, the members only jacket, which was like one of the pride and joys I had. You know, I was so cool in that freaking jacket, you know, but it had puke all over it because that's what we do. And I'm laying in the back of the cab, and I kind of stumble out, and it's a very bright morning, and I wander up to the dispatcher, and he's looking at me, and I'm looking at him, and we know, because he's one of us, and you know, so I get myself together, and I just say I can't do this anymore. So, you know, that was the beginning, and. You know, initially, I'm trying to think back of when I came back. I think the thing that I thought of most was that to understand truly what it meant to be powerless over alcohol. You know, and there's much to be said about being powerless. You know, I thought that I always thought that my drinking was a run of bad luck. You know, or I thought my drinking was, you know, if that cop hadn't been there, you know, I thought my drinking was one of these things, but really it meant what it means to me today and started to mean to me then was I was powerless over alcohol. And, you know, and all I had to do for that moment, you know, at that time was just do that for one day, you know, that I had that to have no reservations about the fact that I was powerless over alcohol for that one day, you know, and that was the beginning of my step work. You know, I had done the steps before. And I'd gone through this gone through all 12 of them, but there was something that I left out, and I won't say that it was the reason, but I would say the reason what is true is that it wasn't the reason that I drank, because I left this thing out and didn't. Why it probably got me drunk was that once I found out that I had not put something in my fourth and fifth step, and I didn't share it with my sponsor. You know, I held on to that secret, you know. And like it says, you're as sick as your secrets. I will say more accurately, I think it was sick as was secretive. You know, it was my idea that I wanted to hide that from somebody. I didn't want anybody to know that, because if I knew that, I'd probably have to give it back. It was a piece of jewelry. And I didn't want to give it back, you know. And, you know, so that was the lesson for me, is, you know, leave no stone unturned, you know, when I do the steps again. And so, you know, that 16 months, you know, got me through, I, you know, did the steps during those times. But, you know, coming back, the first step, you know, admitted I'm powerless over alcohol, my life had become unmanageable. You know, that unmanageability stuff, you know, is pretty obvious at the time, you know, when you're having trouble holding the job and you're drinking all the time and, you know, you really, in my case, just depressed and not happy. You know, and candidly, in 84, things weren't, you know, horrible. You know, I was living at home with my mom, which 24-year-old is, you know, it's not horrible, but, you know, it's not the best. I'm going to school, but, you know, so, you know, things, it wasn't the worst it had ever been, but it was the worst internally it had been, you know. You know, AA will screw up your drinking. And every time I went out and got drunk, I could never hide from the fact that, like I had talked about even in the beginning, this is something that I probably shouldn't be doing. And I just couldn't get away from that. And so, you know, I go through the steps with my sponsor, and I do the fifth step again, and I tell him about this thing that I kept, you know, hidden. And I know I was done with that part, you know, because the fifth step, because I know that I'm empty. And I basically told, I searched as best as I could at that time of all the things that I had done, all the feelings that I had. I'd done what I'd done, and I was empty. And I went to him, and we did our fifth step. And, you know, the thing that strikes me about looking back at this is there's no, this is a typical AA story, you know. And I want to be anything other than your average alcoholic, but that's what I am. I'm your average garden variety alcoholic. And, you know, so when I try to think of, you know, what was cool and exciting and what was different about, you know, what bang up thing could I tell you, there really isn't anything. I'll tell you that one of the things that happened to me was during this time of doing the steps, it was and this time being back, when I got down on my knees and, I did say to God, as I understand him, that I just can't do this on my own. So that is certainly one thing. And I haven't had to drink since then. You know, and I did that fifth step. And I did that sixth and seventh step, and I made amends, you know, through the eighth and ninth step. A lot of my stuff, and every time I talk about the ninth step, there is still one thing on that ninth step I haven't done. You know, and every time I talk about it, I get reminded and say, when are you going to do that? So I just want to say it's progress, not perfection, even 33 years. I haven't done that. And it's a financial amend. And it's one of those amends that I'm not quite sure how to deal with it. You know, I could just take the money that I owe this person and donate it to charity and be done with it. And maybe that's what I'll do. But I bring it up whenever we come to the eighth and ninth steps to just remind me that I there's still some things I just hang on to. So I'm also a garden variety alcoholic who could procrastinate for a pretty long period of time. That would have been, I was sober 7 years when that happened. So not only did it was that I was sober 7 years when I did this wrong. You know, so we don't always get perfect when we're sober, that's for sure. So fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, and ninth, and, you know, the rest of the story is really about, as you would expect, is about a deeper understanding of who I am and what my relationship with God is, and how do I give back? You know, how do I live 10 and 11 and 12? And so the first thing that I'll say about 10, 11, and 12 is specifically about God, and that is I had this relationship. I had a trouble with God, and like a lot of people here in AA have trouble with God, and I told my sponsor this, and he He said, well, I don't think you have trouble with God. I think you have trouble with you. And, you know, don't worry about God. And I was trying to figure out how to do this second and third step. And, you know, I'm having this trouble with God. And he said, just don't worry about that. You know, just know that it's not you. And I got to tell you, that's probably the biggest thing about God is that I'm not, right? The thing I need to know about God is that I'm not. And one of the things that happened out of my sobriety and happened in the past 5 or 6 years was I felt the call to become an ordained deacon in the Catholic Church. And so I followed that, and I bring that up to talk about a conversation I had with my priest. He said, and another pastor from a Lutheran church, says one of the contributions that AA has is about this not God. You know, and it's not the book titled Not God, which is the anti-spiritual thing. It has to do with, this is a very spiritual statement. I am not God. I believe in God, but I am not that God. And they love that about AA. It's one of the things we bring to, you know, the spiritual discussion, a simple view that whatever our concept of God, as long as it's not us, it's probably going to be a workable concept. And so, you know, and that came from my sponsor, you know. Said, don't worry about it. As long as you're not God, you'll be fine. So, and that's been that's the short version, right? So the rest of the struggle is how not to be God in my life. That's the short, you know, and I can show lots of examples of how I play God in my life, you know, and it fails. And I can give you lots of examples of how when I let go and let God, how life is pretty good. So I think I need to talk about this because I'm sure that there are some people in this room who may identify with this. So one of the things about not being God is that I understanding that I'm truly powerless over alcohol, and I'm truly powerless over alcohol when alcoholism exists in people I love. And, you know, over the past 4 or 5 years, I've been experiencing that with my son. And, you know, one of the things that it's a very interesting thing about alcoholism, even when you're, even as long as I've been sober, to have to deal with this from the outside, because it brought me face to face even more deeply with my own powerlessness over alcohol, you know, is this idea. And, you know, I would get angry at him and I would try to cajole him, you know, most of the dad stuff, right? You're trying to control the situation. So I'm trying to control an active alcoholic and addict, right? And you know how that goes. And it didn't work with me. The insanity and the idea that I thought it would work with me and him shows you how I still struggle, as you would expect, I still struggle with the idea I'm not God. You know, people couldn't solve my problem. I needed a spiritual solution. You know, it was the God as I understand him. The fact that I got down on my knees and I continue, you know, and asked God to help me. And I did that on a regular basis over and over and over, over long periods of time and years that I'm even standing up here today. Why I would think that I would suddenly be powerful over alcohol just because it's in my son is insanity, right? So, you know, it kind of makes you think about, you know, the other areas in my life. And so the other areas have to do with, you know, being a parent and how to, you know, which I clearly didn't let go of is alcoholism, but it's all about how to let go and still be a parent, you know, how to let go and still be a spouse, how to let go and still be a worker, you know, finding that balance, you know, because part of me when I let go just wants to forget about it, right? Not do anything, but you know that doesn't. That's not what letting go asks us to do. Letting go asks us to let go of the results, you know, but still do the actions, right? I still have to dress up and show up and go to work, you know. I still have to be a father and a husband, and you know, and a coworker and another AA member. So, one of the things that I talked about, you know, this inventory, which I continue to do, and I do inventories today, which are primarily spot check inventories, and every year or so I go out and I'll do a retreat and I'll do an inventory then. And, you know, pretty much what the 10th step says, you know, my conscience today is the thing that pricks my, that starts the inventory process going, you know, because when I'm not comfortable, you know, I know something's wrong. That's what I use, you know, and so that's the 10th step for me. And the 11th step for me, you know, as I said, I'm a deacon in the church, so that's exposed me to a lot of different spiritual ideas, and I hope nobody hates me after saying that, but, you know, because I didn't understand clerics. I'll say one thing about clerics that I know today that I didn't know before I became one. They're very human. Very, very human. You know, and the best ones are really aware of how broken they are. And just like us, right? Just like us, how we get, I think we're at our best when we know how truly powerless we are, how truly broken we are, how many defects of character we have, and that the thing that allows me to walk through this world with any sort of peace is the grace of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And so the best clerics know that too. So I clearly don't look at them the same way I did when I was 22 or even 40. You know, and just like us, there are good ones and bad ones. And you know, that was a newsflash to me. My expectation of them, they were supposed to be perfect. You know, and it's one of the things that, you know, when I look at my resentments against, you know, parents and against, you know, the church and clerics and, you know, police officers and all these people, I expect them to be perfect, and they're not, you know, and that was just, I had a very skewed view of the world, you know, where I expected all you to be perfect, but not me, right? Well, I guess that wasn't true either. I expected myself to be perfect to some extent, which is part of the problem. So, I'm working back to, you know, my life today, the what it's like, you know. So, during this time that I've been sober, one of the resentments I had was towards the church and towards God, and you know, I started going to church and trying to find out and just make peace. And I think when I talk about this to people, I'm not trying to proselytize anybody into any particular religion. But if you like me had an issue with God, I couldn't run away from it, and I don't think you could. You can either. And I had to make peace with the church. It was all my resentments as an institution. I also had to make peace with God. And, you know, that ended up being me getting ordained. It doesn't end up like that for everybody. But because like I said a few minutes ago, the reason I'm standing here is because I asked God for help and His grace. And I've become more aware of that. In the time when I practiced this 11th step, you know, because, you know, I'm supposed to be in that 11th step drawing closer to Him, you know, and there are a couple of different ways you can do that. You know, there's the active and the passive, right? The active, which we do, and I've done in AA, is basically be of service. You know, get closer to God by getting close to people, being of service. You know, not thinking about myself all the time. And, you know, that is certainly one way of improving my conscious contact with God, because you are in front of me and are my conscious contact with God. So if I serve the people of AA and of my church, I am in that way, you know, growing in conscious contact with God. The other way, of course, is, you know, the more contemplative way, which is, you know, which I have found to find a lot of peace. Because that was the thing I didn't have. You know, I was drinking primarily to get at peace with myself and peace with the world, right? And alcohol was my drug of choice to do that. You know, I've chosen other things in my sobriety. Of course, I chose real drugs, but I've also chosen food and sex and all anything that I could fill that God-shaped hole with, I have tried to do. You know, so and all of them fail. You know, and the only thing that I've found that has filled that is being of service on the active side and spending time with God. And, you know, I'll bring up what, you know, everybody knows. If you want to improve your relationship with somebody, you don't run away from them, right? I have to spend time with them. And that's what I do in that step, you know, when I do it. Now, I'll also share, this is Lent for those of you who are Christian, and I decided I would do that, just that. You know, I wouldn't give up chocolate for Lent. I would go and I would say, I'm going to practice a daily prayer and meditation, which is consistent with what AA asked me to do and is consistent with what my church asked me to do. I'm going to try to do this for 40 days. You know, 6 out of 10. You know, it's, you know, and if I get 6 out of 10, you know, hell, if I get 4 out of 10, that's good too, right? Because it's better than nothing. But I share that because, once again, it's this whole progress, not perfection. And sometimes I forget that, and you know. But I'll also share that when I do spend those time in time with the God of my understanding, I do find a new freedom and a new happiness. You know, I have experienced at one time in my life, to a greater or lesser degree, the promises, you know, that happen at the end of the ninth step. You know, I'm not free of, I know this new freedom and this new happiness. You know, I value my past, you know, because my past is my treasure. You know, it allows me, you know, however well I did it tonight, to be able to share with somebody who's trying to figure out, are they alcoholic? You know, is this program for you? And I realize there might be some people who hear it who are not in this room, you know. So if you want to know if this program is for you, you know, and you heard something that triggered that for you, I hope you find that, you know, you can come to AA or get help to know that you got this thing, you know. And once you know that you got this thing, you know that there's help out there, you know, for you. And that was, you know, I didn't, you know, even though my dad was in recovery, he eventually got in recovery, you know, and I knew of AA, you know, but I didn't really, I knew of AA. I knew that that my dad went there and got sober for a little while, and then he drank, and he died. So I had all that old gamut of AA can help you. You can see how it benefits your life. And then if you don't maintain, you know, your spiritual condition, or if you choose to go to, you know, if you choose to enjoy all the benefits we get from the program, in other words, you know, a freedom to go to the opera, or freedom to live a life that we didn't live as drunks, which is what he did. You know, he decided he'd rather go to the opera than go to AA meetings. He decided he'd rather spend time with his wife than go to AA meetings. He'd rather go to ball games than spend time. So he started drifting away from the program, you know, but we are called to stay. I wish I hadn't left. I'm sorry, I'm really tired tonight, but he sort of lost his focus, and it's and that lesson was not lost on me. You know, that's one of the reasons I'm still here, unfortunately, is because my dad passed from this. And I remember that, you know, not to get too well, not to get too confident that I've got this thing licked, you know, because it's really a day-to-time thing. Now, I do a lot of work, I like to think, you know, to ensure that I don't take another drink, you know, and part of that service work, you know, that active part of spirituality is, you know, being involved with other guys who I sponsor and who are truly my blessing in Alcoholics Anonymous, because, you know, they remind me of what it was like. They also, you know, get me out of myself, you know, which is, I'm still no different than anybody else from the time I walked in here. If I'm sitting, you know, thinking about Tom, then I am in a bad spot. So, you know, being able to be focused and helpful to other people, you know, is really a big part of my sobriety, and, you know, certainly what's kept me here. And even if I'm not sponsoring people, I try to stay active in a group, you know, because that's the other thing, to be of service. You know, and like I said, I'm active in my own church, but that's a personal thing. But I was active in AA a lot longer than I was active and have been active in church. And I also say that one of the things that that's happened to me is, you know, I was very active after I was ordained, and I was very active in the church, and I didn't let my AA meetings suffer, but I sort of let my AA practices suffer, you know, because I thought I was covering it on then, and, you know, but I got to say that I'm the most effective minister I can be by being who I really am in here. And who I am in here is an alcoholic who got sober, who comes to meetings and helps other alcoholics. And if I maintain truth to that person, I take care of the person who I really am at core is an alcoholic who needs not to drink, then I'm a much more effective everything. You know, so if I focus on the one thing that keeps me alive, everything else can fall into place, given enough time. It doesn't immediately fall into place, but it can. And that has been helpful to me, you know, when I think about, you know, because I always have had pulls in my sobriety, you know, that try to pull me away from the core of who I am and what I need to take care of. You know, it's been marriage, You know, I got married in Alcoholics Anonymous to a lovely woman. We have two children, one of which I've already talked about. The other one is just, I don't talk about her because she's not a problem, right? Poor girl gets a short shrift. She's up in D.C. doing great, you know. But, you know, so two kids, marriage, you know, house. I have a long-term job. All the material stuff is pretty good. You know, we can always have more money, right? But never can be too thin or have too much money or enough sex or whatever. Where I was going with that was, you know, just taking care of the things that got me here, the things that allow me to stand up in front of you and say that, you know, I'm a deacon in the church, or that my kids are wonderful, or that this, that, and the other thing is because I stayed sober in Alcoholics Anonymous a day at a time, you know, for over 33 years. And, you know, once, I don't know where I was going to go with that. I think that what I'm running through my, what I made sure, I, one of the things I was coming up here, I wanted to make sure I, if you hear me speak next week or next month or next year, you may get a completely different share. I just want you to know that I had no idea what I was going to say when I walked up here, you know, except the idea of what it, you know, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And that doesn't mean my story changed. It just means what comes to my mind and what I think about when I'm standing up here doing this sort of stream of consciousness talking, you know, and sharing with you about what happened to me in sobriety. You know, what gets highlighted at any one point is, you know, changes from day to day, like my perspective. So, like I said, you know, you pretty much got the whole thing, you know, about being a scared kid who solved his fear through alcohol and was different than his fellows, and the fact that once I took a drink, there's a physical compulsion that starts, you know. Now, I always had the, you know, which made me different. You know, a lot of people try to get over fear through alcohol and drugs. They don't necessarily become alcoholic. It's only those of us who have the genetic predisposition, the gene, you know, that metabolizes alcohol. You know, I'm physically different than my fellows. You know, and that's a hard thing. That's what's hard about for my son. He doesn't understand that he's physically different. He doesn't want to be physically different. And we don't want to be physically different, you know. But I am. And that was the thing that, you know, like I said, people, you know, use crutches, you know, drugs, food, alcohol, whatever, to serve, but not all of them become alcoholic and addicts. And it's that subset that I'm talking to where, you know, we're genetically different. You know, we have metabolized all this stuff different, you know. You know, so the beginning starts with a fear-based kid who drinks alcohol, becomes alcoholic, you know, suffers the consequences legally, you know, emotionally and physically. You know, some things happen to me physically because of the way I drank. You know, who gets sober in AA and gratefully, you know, gets busted by the law and has all those consequences, gets sober at 24 and is still sober at 57. You know, that's a great story, you know. And I'm eternally grateful to God and to AA, you know, that I walked into the room. I'm just grateful because, you know, the other thing is, you know, when I've had two people recently go out and get drunk, you know, after some early time in sobriety, and they're just shocked at how quickly it went bad. You know, in one case, one guy got drunk and shot out the windows of his neighbor's car, and now he's got a felony weapons charge on him. Another guy totaled, you know, his car, and so now he doesn't have a car, and his whole school life is going down because you can't go to school and down to community college if you live in, you know, 50 miles away. You can't go because you don't have a car. So, you know, these things just happen, and they're just amazed. And that's the thing about me. I don't entertain the thought of drinking, and you know, and I don't, and part of the reason is because I don't know what would happen. I can't tell you today that if I decided to some, that I really believe somehow it's just a bad phase, that if I were to walk out next week and go out and have a drink, I just don't know what would happen. I can't swear to you that I will, you know, just total my life, but I can't swear to you I won't. You know, and is that worth the risk? You know, man, for me it's not today, and you know, it's only for today. So, you know, I hope I've helped somebody out tonight. And it's, Sam, as you know, it always helps for the alcoholic to tell his story. So thank you all for being great listeners, and thanks.